We Kelpians are born afraid. It's how we survive. My whole life, I have never known a moment without fear. Not one moment. Until now.
There will be time to grieve. This is not that time.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, back to his persnickety snelf.
And we have a very special guest, emerging from the woods after looking at translucent flowers, Dale DeRuiter.
Hello, guys. How's it going?
Doing well. Dale, great to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
Last time we were covering, what was it, the two-parter for Voyager, where they're back to the 1990s. Past tense, is that the one?
No, it wasn't no. Past tense.
No?
It was Basics.
Yes,
the classic Basics.
Okay.
People always hold that one up as their favorite Voyager two-parter. But it's pretty good.
You know, I think Learning Curve could have been expanded to be like a two-part episode, and that would have been the best finale ever for season one.
That's my fan fiction.
Yeah. Okay. Anyways, nice. So Dale, of course, we're tackling Star Trek Discovery. This is mm-hmm. the first time you've been able to join us since it hit the air. And Cam, what exactly, before we get into maybe Dale's thoughts on Star Trek Discovery, what's the theme of this particular episode that we're doing?
We're going to talk about space madness, because the Discovery episode this week is C.V. Pacem, Parabellum. And this is an episode where Saru goes down on an alien planet and finds himself infected by magical alien energy and goes a little wacky.
He's definitely impacted by his experience down there. So we'll get into that in just a minute. But first, Dale, we've had like various guests on telling us about like their feelings about the show. It's kind of a wide spectrum of everyone's thoughts here. But where are you falling so far, 8 episodes into Star Trek Discovery?
Well, I'm going to kind of say a cop-out and then back it up, because... Uh-oh. I love it, but there are things that are bugging me.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what I love is I feel Star Trek has finally kind of mastered aliens. Like with Saru that we've already brought up, you see his face and you're not like, oh, that's a guy wearing a mask. You're like, that's an actual alien. I'm totally in.
Yeah.
So I guess they could put this, like, if Star Trek was a person, they would put this series on their resume as like, look how good we do aliens now. And it's awesome. The only thing that bugs me is this whole Klingon thing.
Yes.
I haven't heard any complaints about this.
Okay.
My complaints is not that they look different or whatever, but I just figured that was always me being like, I don't exactly know the lore of Klingons because I'm not a huge fan. The thing that bugs me is there's like not, it was more when the series began, it was super Klingon heavy. And you'd have to listen to Klingon for like 5 minutes at a time.
Yeah.
And I don't want to sound like the bad Trekkie, but I don't like the Klingon language necessarily. And it's kind of...
It's not like
too
French.
Much. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not the romantic language of the Star Trek universe.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like the tech looks great. The characters are good. Oh, one thing. It's kind of weird because this is like, I'm going to kind of say this is gateway Star Trek, because it feels like they kind of backed off on the Star Trekness so that they could pull in like casual fans and people who aren't necessarily Trekkies to watch it. And
they want to make it a little hipper.
Yeah, exactly. And the one spot that's really failing me is I've always been a Doctor's guy. Like the Doctor has always been my favorite character. And for Discovery, I had to actually go on IMDb to find out the Doctor's name, because he's just never in there, and he's like a throwaway character.
I do wonder what the future is for one Dr. Hugh Culber on this series.
Yeah.
You know, but maybe they do want to change things around, and maybe he's just going to be introduced in season one and becomes more prominent in season two.
Or they just don't care that much about the Doctor character on this series.
Yeah.
Which would be a bit of a mix-up.
Yeah. But he's more in kind of the recurring character role that we haven't really seen since Next Gen season two with Dr. Pulaski. So it's kind of a change of pace there. But overall, look, if you had to compare it to any other series that you've watched with regards to Star Trek, what do you think this one's closest to?
Well, again, it's kind of a cop out, but it's closest to Enterprise.
Yeah.
Because it's like it's just a modern take, and they're trying to make the tech still look old-ish.
Right.
So you kind of fall into problems there. Like with the spore drive, you're like, well, how long till the spore drive's gone? Because they don't have it in the future.
Yeah.
So you're kind of like, it's kind of like spoils it because you're like, I know this is going to end. Are they going to do it in season one or season two?
Does it take some of this tension away? Because we kind of know where we're going eventually. We know that there's not going to be a spore drive, you know, in Picard's era, etc.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the other things is this Klingon war. You know, humans aren't going to get wiped out.
Yeah.
And you know, the Star Trek, basically, all the ships will still be there. So it's kind of like a low risk war.
It's true. Like with the Dominion War in DS9, mm-hmm. you know, the 24th century was as far as we'd been.
Yeah.
And we were at that point, you know, kind of as it was unfolding. So you mm-hmm. didn't know how it was going to shake up that universe. In this case, we know how the universe is going to get shaken out, which is sort of an issue. How have you, you know, this has been the first serialized Star Trek, like really serialized.
Mm-hmm.
How have you kind of felt about the overall arc of the series up until, I guess, you know, this episode that we watched tonight?
Well, I think the overall arc, even though I said I didn't like the Klingons, I really like that aspect of like having the different houses, having the civil war inside the Klingons. And then in this episode, they kind of like brought up the girl gonna defect, and then you're like, what's gonna happen with that? And that's really cool. So overall, I'd like the serialization of it. I like that they gave us, not this episode, but the last one was kind of like a standalone episode.
Yeah.
Just like as a breather.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is her name Laurel or Liar L? I don't know. Come on. So why don't we dive into it with regards to Space Madness, Cam?
Yeah.
Because when we tackled that episode a couple of years ago, we were...
Was it years ago?
I think it was, yeah.
Now that's terrifying.
Yeah. but we tackled it in the way, like, looked at episodes that dealt with this repeating trope in Star Trek about, like, if you're out in space long enough, your mind's going to go to places that it wouldn't normally go. So we tackled episodes like, say... I think Revulsion from Star Trek Voyager, The Thaw from Voyager as well.
Yeah, I think we talked about The Enemy Within with Kirk kind of going wacky. We talked about, the episode where Picard goes wacky on the ship. What is it? It has the word time in it.
Yeah.
It's not time squared.
It's Timescape.
Timescape. Thank you. Yeah.
So it's like we're seeing like kind of the impacts of outer space on people. We definitely see Saru impacted by his experience on this planet. Planets, of course, are in outer space. So
yes.
There you go. But
close enough, people.
Yeah, so we're kind of wondering about how our take on this version of so-called space madness.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of the space madness concept, I don't think, unless it tells me something about the character. In this case, it allowed us to see more of the vulnerable side of Saru, a character I think has been a little bit too stoic, at least a handful of episodes leading up to this, where he was positioned very much from the outset as like, this is the new Data, this is the new Spock, characters who are beloved, you know, in fandom. Even the lesser loved ones like T'Pol in Enterprise is still a huge... you know, popular character for a lot of people. They're still elevated above a lot of the rest of the cast.
They're kind of the one common quality, though, is like they're the other.
Yes.
The outsider.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, Saru is in that position, but maybe because of the arc, it is often felt like he's overshadowed on the series. You know, I think last week he had like just a couple scenes on the bridge with Lorca.
Yeah, he was not invited to the party.
No, he was not.
tough shake, man.
He'd be a party pooper, though.
Yeah. Come on.
Yeah.
But
his threat ganglio would just be like spreading everywhere and just be like, oh, come on.
I liked that this episode at least allowed us through the madness to kind of get a little bit of a better understanding of his psychological state. We'll get into how well it did that, but I will say that I liked that at least the madness was being used for that reason.
Yeah, what's your take, Dale, on characters? Cam brought up the fact that he's not usually a fan of these kinds of episodes. My issue is that it takes away a lot of agency from the characters in which they're not in control of mm-hmm. their actions. So to a certain degree, I check out a little
bit. We're waiting for them to be cured.
Yeah.
That's it.
So that's usually my issue with this. I think this episode did address some of those problems mm-hmm. that I have with it. But Dale, what's your take on, I guess, Saru's version of space madness here?
Well, it was kind of cool because I'd always thought Saru was just like a weak, gangly guy. And he's like like he says in this episode, he's born afraid. And so you just think of him as timid and kind of like a wet blanket, but he kind of kicked ass for a little bit.
Are you
bit.
Writing Valentine's for him right now?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's just, it was funny because even though his 80 kilometer run was a bit wonky, he did.
What are you talking about?
He did hit Michael with a nice donkey kick, and he looked like he's a pretty good hand to hand fighter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
he could take a stick to the head pretty easily, too. So I was disappointed the stick didn't break in half, though.
That would have been great.
Yeah.
It makes sense, though, like a prey species like that. The fact that he survived this long probably means he can get away in a fight and hold his own to a certain degree, at least enough to, be able to run away.
I just wish there was some Benny Hill music playing over him
running.
Running, yeah. That would have been great.
They should have just done the cheaper version of that, like in the original Superman movie that Donner did, where they just like elevated the actor and just like whipped him, you know, on a cable down a, like through the cornfields. It actually looked better than this.
I don't know if it quite would have worked with the wilderness, though.
Maybe not. I think it would have looked better, though, than this. This looked just goofy.
No, because a cornfield's one thing, but like there's branches in the way. Like,
put things in front of the legs. They could have positioned that those CG blades of grass in front of his legs.
I don't know. I mean, you haven't convinced me yet, Cam.
Well, come on. Look at what we got. You're saying it couldn't have been better?
I don't know. The cornfield stuff didn't exactly impress me.
Really? In the original Superman? I thought it actually worked really well.
To me, it looked like a guy in front of a green screen, kind of like.
When he's running alongside the train and stuff?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. To me, it just had a more, it looked like a physical human being doing this versus a kind of CG creature that's sort of jittering around the screen.
Sure.
Yeah. Awkwardly.
Right. So what about his journey, though? Because essentially what Saru likes about this planet and the reason why he comes kind of under their influence, though, is this idea of harmony, a way to find that there is no threats at all. Because this is, like you said, Cam, he's a prey species and he said not one moment has he ever experienced anything without fear.
Right.
So this is a guy who comes to a planet and he realizes he could live in harmony, and why not pursue this sort of life? What do you think about his overall character journey here, guys?
I think one of the things they could have done was, since they kind of delved into the space madness where he wasn't doing what he was doing, they could have done a little bit of hallucinations.
Right.
And kind of brought in the predator species from his home planet and kind of showed how he'd react to that. And then we get to see what, I guess, the bigger, tougher version of Saru's race would be.
I bet they're giant versions of, remember the puppy dog with the horn on it in the original series episode, Ken? Yeah. I bet like they're like giant versions of that.
Right. Well, that is terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if this episode was maybe one episode too early for Saru. I wonder if we should have had another kind of Saru standalone before we got to this episode. Mm.
Fill out the background a little bit more on this
character. Yeah, I don't feel like I know this character that well. And now we're being plunged into him running mad saying, like, I want to live in harmony. I want to live in harmony. And you're like, you haven't seemed that miserable on Lorca's bridge.
Yeah. But, I definitely get the sense, and I think everybody's commenting on it, like he seems to be out of place on Lorca's bridge, much more so than any other character aboard that bridge.
But is that us observing that versus, like, is the show telling us that?
Well, I would say us observing that, though.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, that's what I'm saying. I feel like the show is not giving us episodes that really emphasize that. I feel like we're looking at it going, well, logically, this character makes no sense on this bridge.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, I would like an episode where we saw a little more of the conflict within him being on that bridge, maybe before we got to this, because there is the one episode, was it Context is for Kings, or was it The Butcher's Knife, where there's the scene of him, Stamets, and Lorca kind of arguing back and forth about the spore drive.
Right.
You know, we're seeing something out of Saru there, but I feel like he's been ignored in the episodes leading up to this one. I just would have liked to know more about his personal feelings being on the Discovery right now, going into this episode.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What do you figure? Are you digging Saru so far as a character? I should have asked you this at the beginning, though, because this is what we've been asking like a lot of our guests, though. It's like, who are you digging as far as characters go so far?
Actually, her roommate.
Tilly.
Oh, Tilly.
Yeah. I like her. Mostly I like her because in previous Star Trek, she would have been the awkward alien. But now they kind of got away with it. She was just in the first episode. She's like, I'm special. So she has that like social awkwardness to her. And which allows her to give some punchlines out of nowhere that you don't expect.
Right.
Like last episode when she was, I'm guessing, drunk at the party.
Yeah.
So I like her a lot, just but more because her, I guess, her awkward state is
endearing. It easier to, like, empathize with her or, like, kind of relate to her? I'm not saying you're an awkward man, but...
I think people could pick that
but,
up.
But she seems a little bit more human than, say, Burnham, who does, you know, Vulcan karate all the time.
Yeah, and I do... And also, I just want to show that I also like Lorca, who's the complete opposite.
Yeah.
I like him because he goes back to, like, say, Voyager, when they were, like, half of them were warriors and they joined up out of necessity. I really like how he's kind of, like, he's dealing with PTSD, but he's pushing it down and he's just, like, a warrior captain.
So is he, like, a badass Chakotay? Is this the Chakotay you always hoped for?
Yes, it is. Okay. This is the make good for Chakotay.
Well, do you think another comparison could be Rudy Ransom from the Equinox two-parter? Do you remember season 6-7? I think it was the season 6-7.
I think it's 6.
Yeah, where essentially we have that other Federation starship that had found itself in the Delta Quadrant, and it really emphasized that Voyager had a relatively easy go of it during their experience, whereas the Equinox crew really had to throw their morals away and harm aliens and do what they had to do to survive. I got a lot of Rudy Ransom kind of vibes out of one Gabriel Lorca here.
Yeah. I would say that's an apt description.
Okay.
I really like that two-parter. And Rudy Ransom was such an interesting character. It makes sense that they would want to go back to that well.
Yeah.
Mm.
I don't know that they've hit that real sweet spot like they did with Rudy Ransom yet with Lorca. I'm still waiting for that one episode to kind of put him over the top.
I think they don't want to spill the beans too early about what a messed up dude he is.
I want to talk about something, though, that you guys actually just reminded me of. I was going to bring up on this podcast, and fortunately it was a Saru episode, so I have the opportunity to. You know, we talked about Lorca as a PTSD character. Tilly is a character who could be someone on the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at, like, Data, we've seen at conventions, or 7 of 9, we've seen people come up to the mic to ask, you know, the actors who played these characters questions and say, this character meant a lot to me as someone who is, you know, like autism or Asperger's or something along those lines. Is Saru the first character we've seen who represents someone with an anxiety disorder and a severe one at that?
If he is, I think people will be too afraid to go up to the mic and tell him that. Sorry, that was a very, very,
very insensitive, Tyler.
Insensitive joke. I apologize.
But it's something I think about because I'm someone who has had anxiety disorders over the years.
Yeah.
Never to an extreme. Like I've met people who have them very, very bad. And he's a character who lives in constant threat and terror. And I wonder if this is the first Trek character we're seeing who sort of symbolizes that.
Yeah.
I think, I agree with you, and I think I guess an example would be when he was captain for that episode, and he had set up the computer to rate him basically and reassure his
hot
confidence.
Or not. Yeah, it's the 23rd like, century version of hot or not. Yeah.
Am I a good captain, computer?
Yeah.
And then I like how he just didn't get the answer and just kind of deleted the program.
He had a chili pepper next to his name. It was rate my prof. Did you guys ever notice had chili peppers next to their names?
Yeah, I know. But I mean, like, one of the big byproducts of anxiety disorder is like negative thoughts. Mm-hmm. And you see a lot of that through Saru as well. There's like, there's a real sense of like always like he's a character who wears like his sort of negative opinions about himself on his sleeve. Like you can see that he's a character who's very uncomfortable in his skin. More so than like, you know, your Data's, your 7 of 9's.
So who do you think he's the closest character to with regards to Star Trek main characters at this point? I that's a bit of a tough one. I do dig that he's a bit of a unique animal here, but
In terms of the insecurities, I would say Odo lines up very well. Like, Odo always seemed very uncomfortable.
Yeah. Mm. Especially when, remember, he was in his humanoid solid form.
Like, yeah.
He was very, very uncomfortable during that period of time.
Very much so. But no, I don't think any of these other characters have his fear. Like, I don't think any of them live in fear like he does.
So this anxiety disorder kind of comparison, like, I can totally buy it. I do wonder how it is kind of a reflection of them making these characters very distinct. You brought up Tilly. You know, she's brought up her special condition. I think a lot of people have kind of assumed that maybe she's somewhere on the spectrum.
Right.
We've got maybe kind of Saru going forward with this kind of anxiety sort of metaphor here. So it also kind of brings me to the point where, is Ash Tyler a real character yet? Is there anything distinct about him?
He loves trout.
Well, that's, yes, that's what we found out.
Lake Shasta is where it's at.
I'm still kind of, I like the actor a lot. Mm-hmm. I just don't know if they're giving him much here.
Well, you know, we talk about Lorca having PTSD. It would seem that Ash Tyler is also a PTSD case here.
Who's far more fascinating?
I feel like he's not really as traumatized by his time in the Klingon ship as he should be.
What are you talking about, Dale? He's like, I'm so angry. I want to strike back at them. Yeah, I want you to hurt them.
Yeah, it's like
the passion inside of me.
Yeah, he was like, I was tortured so much that I learned their way of fighting, but I would rather talk about fish.
I mean, it's just weird that like all the other characters seem so well defined. And Cam, you and I, we've talked about this every single week since he's been introduced, and we keep kind of waiting for this character to kind of spring to life in a way that the other characters haven't been able to do.
Most of them were pretty much out of the gate, had a very distinct personal quirk, maybe one that made them a little unlikable. And you'd hear fans complaining about that when, say, like Stamets was introduced or some of the others. They'd be like, you know, this character is not likable.
Right.
But I mean, I'm curious if fans out there, and I don't really know, are finding Ash Tyler likable, because he's fitting the bland profile that I think people might find, you know, oh, this guy's, you know, he seems fun.
Yeah. I'm not hearing any anti-Ash Tyler sentiment out there in social media, but I'm not seeing a lot of pro-Ash Tyler sentiment either. I think it's a lot of indifference.
I'm thinking it's weird because this episode, I felt he could go like a very Paris direction in his character development, because it seems like he could be like the hotshot, does whatever, like when he was that at last episode or the one before where they're doing the shooting drills with Lorca?
Right. That was two episodes ago.
And yeah. That was Lethe. Yeah.
He totally crushed the Captain Lorca with his ability to shoot. And you just kind of don't get, I guess, the character doesn't really bring that through. Like, he doesn't seem like a super soldier.
Well, he doesn't seem to have that intensity.
Yeah.
You know, and he also doesn't have sort of that Captain America, like, I'm going to save the day kind of spirit either. He has neither. He has nothing.
Yeah, I'm just kind of like, I want to like this character.
I can't believe it's not Butter of Star Trek characters.
Fabio?
A bird's gonna hit him on a roller coaster. Boy, there's a reference that goes way back.
I just think this camping trip had some potential for him.
Yeah.
To kind of.
You'd
show
think
off.
So. He's in nature. He could have opened up a bit.
But, I don't think we really got it in this episode. I'm hoping.
Well, this had the big romantic moment, too, where we finally had the quote-unquote first kiss with Burnham, because the previous one was erased in the time stream. That moment didn't really do anything for me either.
I don't even remember that moment.
Yeah.
Did it actually happen?
It did.
I was taking notes.
It was when their faces were really red on the blue planet.
Yeah.
I only remember that because I'm like, everything on this planet is blue except for their faces.
Okay.
Which is, I guess, was the setting sun. I'm not sure.
So it makes a lot more sense to me now that Saru comes back to the tent and Tyler's like, we had a fight. And I'm just like, did Riker ever say that to Picard? Like, yeah, Data and me, we had a fight. Like,
does Ash Tyler strike you as a man who fights?
No. He's just like, okay, I was wrong.
Just hangs his head.
Yeah. So, okay. Well,
he's a bizarre character on this show.
I'm waiting for his Saru like episode. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we need to make him distinct in a way that we haven't seen so far.
I would love to know, you know, hopefully one day a book is written about the development of this series.
Yeah.
Because I could imagine, like, Brian Fuller pitched all of these characters except for Ash Tyler, and he was a last-minute add, which explains why he's not fleshed out like the rest.
Well,
it just feels like a character who was written at the last minute.
I'll say, there's that fan theory floating around there, Cam. No spoilers for anybody, but I think that might hold a big explanation behind this character. But I think what you're getting at, though, is that Brian Fuller's well out of the picture by the time that Ash Tyler episode, five?
Yeah.
Shows up.
Yeah.
So if Fuller was still around, like, writing scripts at that point or giving story credits, or I think he would have added a lot more to that character, made him far more distinct, much like we saw with all the other main characters we've been introduced to.
I mean, Fuller would have assisted in writing like the series Bible.
Yeah.
Was Ash Tyler a part of this Bible, or was he come up with after the fact?
Brian Fuller contributed the trout.
He's like, I desperately want a character who loves trout fishing.
Yeah.
Although at this point, it's like we're saying Ash Tyler, he's not really dynamic, but I think in the next episodes, if they were to focus on him and go very dramatic one direction, that would be perfect timing.
So guys, let's talk about next episode, in that this was actually supposed to be the mid-season finale. This is supposed to be kind of a cliffhanger.
Oh yeah, and it is a cliffhanger. I didn't even think of that.
So how do you guys think this measures up as far as, you know, okay, it's tough because this is the first time we've had like a real mid-season finale for Star Trek. We've had Star Trek go on reruns for a couple of weeks during like the Christmas time.
You'd have like two-parters in the mid-season maybe. But that was about it, yeah.
Well, I don't think the two-parters would ever be cut off, like you.
Well,
would
just by a week, in the sense of a cliffhanger episode. Yeah. But yeah, never like this. Yeah.
So, so this was supposed to be the big cliffhanger until we return to the series back in this coming January. How would this have worked as a cliffhanger? Are you that invested in the future of the Pavo?
Well, no. It feels insensitive, but I actually don't care about the Pavo.
Oh,
they see you, Dale.
I do like that they're taking the sarcophagus ship to Pavo instead of just some random bird of prey. I guess that's. I don't know why they had to. They pointed it out. Ensign was like, "It's the sarcophagus ship." Like it was a big deal that that's the ship that's coming.
It's because it's the only recognizable Klingon vessel at this point.
I'll give them some credit. Like during that opening sequence, we didn't even talk about that action-filled opening sequence at the beginning of this episode, in which I finally, for the first time, feel some sort of sense of urgency and scale to this Klingon war, which we'd never really experienced before.
Yeah, where was it the USS Grigori goes down?
Or
is that what it was? It was a name like that.
I think it was Gagarin.
Sure.
Yeah. I'm sure we're all
it's
wrong.
It's gone now. So
who cares? Yeah.
We can grieve later, gentlemen.
So, Cam, that's been our common complaint, though, is we don't really feel all that invested in this Klingon war because it's more of the trope of tell, not show, and that's what we've been getting.
As I was walking over to actually, you know, record this episode tonight, I began to just think, like, you know, with the DS9 Dominion War arc, that was the story. Mm-hmm. Is the Klingon War just a backdrop
to what these characters
are
going
doing
through?
Yeah, exactly. Their individual journeys.
You say that, but my problem is we have so much time spent with the Klingon characters, though.
Yeah.
And they keep making a big deal out of this Klingon War. This Klingon War. So I would like to think that.
People are dying, Tyler.
No. Yeah. They keep, 432 souls this week?
Sure.
Okay. So I would like to think you're right, but I just don't know if I've seen enough evidence of
it. Is that like a lazy excuse that can be like, yeah, that's right, it's just a backdrop?
Well, what do you think about this Klingon War, though, Dale? Because you had mentioned you're not a fan of the subtitles.
Well, no, it is annoying to read all the time. But that opening ship battle was pretty rad, I thought.
Sure,
and yeah. I think the one problem they had with just that scene in general was it felt rushed. Like they were like, get between us and that ship. And then they pan over to the ensign and she has a worried look. And then it's just them in front of the ship. And then they're like, did we get both torpedoes? No, it's blown up. No, like that could have been like, get between the ship and then like, let a couple beats go.
Yeah. Right.
To give like more tension and more energy to it. But it kind of felt like they fast forwarded through that part to get to the planet Pavo, which I think
I was okay with it. I'm just, you know, like to me, it kind of succeeded in establishing that this is a threatening species.
Oh, okay.
And I like the fact that the Discovery didn't save the day.
Right.
The Discovery failed. You know, like this is how dangerous these invisibility screens, as they're calling them.
right.
That's what a danger they pose. And I think that's what they probably set out to do from a story perspective, just to reemphasize the threat of this. But I think we needed a scene like this, like in episode 3 or 4, not in episode 8.
Yeah, because it has been a long time since the Battle of the Binary Stars, and it's kind of faded away just how many people are dying in this war. Because they, at the beginning of every episode, they're like, well, we're in this war and people are dying. We need to stop the war. But they kind of don't show it. So it's nice to get kind of like a refresher on it. And like, I kind of dodged the question before, but I like that there's a background war for this, because we have characters like Lorca, who's like, I don't care what you think of me, Admiral. I'm trying to win this war, even though I'm obviously crazy and something might cause me to snap eventually. But like, we get him signing, or I guess getting Burnham on board and getting her on the bridge too. And
that moment you brought up, though, like, I think that was a fascinating, that Lorca was like, you cannot take the Discovery away from me. It's all I have. And that was like the most vulnerable we've ever seen him. That might have been my favorite Lorca moment so far in the series.
That would have been a perfect single tier moment.
Yeah.
A single tear would have made that a gut punch. Because I remember, I saw that and I was like, whoa, that's very vulnerable. And then they show like the gun in his back. And
so why don't we segue into the Admiral Cornwall story?
Yeah.
Are we confused at all about what's going on? Or should we talk it out to try to figure out? This is how I'm taking it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Laurel's not a fan of Cole.
Right.
But I don't think Laurel wants to defect either, does she? I really don't think so. I think this is all part of her effort to trick Cole into what exactly?
Information.
Giving her more and more power.
Okay.
So she can take him down?
Okay, so
I think that might be it. It's essentially her trying to get into his good graces to rise up the ranks to take him down.
Okay, well, I'm just...
That's my best guess.
I feel like kind of dumb right now because I'm trying to follow what the... Laurel's plan was. Did she tell Cole, I'm going to tell the Admiral that I want to defect just to get the Admiral to talk?
It's possible.
Was that what did you guys take away from this?
Yeah, like, because before she goes into the morgue where there's Klingons in pieces that she recognizes, before that, it seemed like she was going to just jump ship and escape with the Admiral.
But then she got caught.
And then she,
And so then she beat the crap out of the Admiral?
Yeah, maybe killing her. We don't know.
Yeah, seemed like she was dead.
Yeah, we were really confused. We were like, is she supposed to be dead or not? And like, they gave her a strong headbutt and then kind of electrocuted her and then dumped her on the ground. And
maybe that's the cliffhanger that they kind of just Cornwall live? Like, will Cornwall live? And it just seemed like, to me, it felt like she was going to defect. Then she saw the dead bodies and she's like, no, I have to stay here to kill Cole.
Okay. But then they said the Admiral did escape. So the Admiral's alive. Now that I think about it, the Admiral is alive, right?
I think she might have been talking about, because when they found them in the hallway, she was like, oh, she tried to escape.
Oh, right, yeah.
So she might have been saying she escaped and then I caught up with her. Yeah, and that's what the fight that makes you more saw sense. Was.
So
yeah,
then...
very...
But by the end of this, though... Cole is saying, okay, you've pledged fealty to me. I'm going to give you this war paint. And then he says to her, did you really think you could fool me or betray me? But this is after he gave her the war paint? Like, is she and her...
Some mixed messages going on.
I'm just kind of... And Cam, you and I were confused a few episodes ago as well when we didn't even realize it was Laurel for...
On the prison ship.
Yeah, we thought it was like Laurel's cousin. Yeah. That was embarrassing.
Yeah. Well, we did a whole podcast episode with Jesse Arcando talking about this, like, this female prison ship captain.
Yeah.
Unaware that it was Laurel the whole time. Yeah.
Okay. So, I'm just trying to figure out what's going on here. Like,
is this sort of like the Joker in the sense that the plan makes no sense because they're smarter than us? Like, the writer's just like, you know, don't worry. This character is smarter than the audience.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It doesn't matter if it doesn't make sense or not.
But
maybe he heard her because she was mocking Cole for wearing the pink paint on his face. So I guess maybe he heard that and then he put it on her as like a... Now you're wearing the paint that you were mocking me for.
Okay.
It is.
This is like on the last day of school and you like water balloon people. And,
this is like an episode where you're like, you feel bad for like saying something was too ham-fisted and made it too straightforward. Because now you're like, can you water this down a bit?
I know.
Kind of lost.
I never want to like have a show talk down to the audience.
Yeah.
Right.
But I like... And I don't know, my favorite show ever is The Wire. You need to pay attention and follow along what's going on with that series, because they just kind of drop you into it. And a lot of the times you are confused, but you start to figure it out. But here I'm just kind of going like, I don't know what the writers are trying to convey here. And I think that might be a problem.
Is it a case kind of like, you know, Laurel comes from spies and liars, right? And I began to wonder, is she kind of the Garrett character, this figure that is sort of working? You never know what her loyalties are. And so we're going to constantly see her shift back and forth, never quite sure what she wants.
Yeah.
I got to be honest, as confusing as it was, to me, Laurel was the most compelling part of this episode.
Yeah, I agree. I love the Klingon stuff this episode. What about you, Dale? Because you did complain a little bit about like having all these subtitles, you know, blah, blah, blah. But what did you think about the Klingon story part in... What's the name of the episode again, Cam?
C.V. Payson, Parabellum.
Parabellum, okay.
Which translates to, if you want peace, prepare for war.
All right.
If she is actually wanting to defect... I'm going to like that a lot, because it just seems like all these Klingons are a little too one-dimensional. Like, they're like one guy. Like, it seems like the only inner strife in the Klingon Empire right now is one guy wants to unite the houses and the other guy wants to just lead the houses.
Well, let's talk about her thought process about defecting. She said that everything she believed in is gone. She has nothing left anymore. Do you buy this? She says Volk was chased away.
I don't know, because she's a character who lies all the time. So it leads me to wonder if she was even fully ever on board with T'Kuvma.
I think she was.
You think so?
Yes.
Or was it just she figured she could gain power through him?
No, because you know what? She did. I believed her when she said that she saw herself more as a champion for a leader. She doesn't want to be, you know, the one who is in power.
Right.
I totally believe her, especially when we think about, like, she comes from the house of spies and liars, you know, and I totally take her at her word when it comes to that. I think she was genuinely a follower of T'Kuvma. I think everybody on that ship, like, if they're these, you know, kind of fundamentalist religious nutwings, I believe they're in it with T'Kuvma.
Right.
There. So I don't know. I'm fascinated by Laurel. Like, so far, I'm digging her. I'm just very confused about where we're going with this storyline and with this character. Because we've been confused very much so the last two times she's been on the show.
Yeah.
Do you feel like this is a one-season character or an ongoing character into the future?
I think my bold prediction is Ash is going to kill her.
Okay.
And then his direction will come from getting revenge from being her love slave.
Right.
Right.
So, like, he seemed pretty upset about that when somebody made a joke being like, haha, slave, yeah, right. And he was like, no, it's terrible.
Yeah.
So I think he's, and like how he hinted this episode, how he wants to hurt the Klingons. And they're like, yeah, we all do. It's a war. He's like, no, but.
Right.
So I think he'll maybe have like a psychotic break, kill her in either the last episode or the second last episode.
Right.
And then that'll change his character dynamic with the rest of the crew.
Right.
Okay. So they do have a conversation about prisoners of war.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What do you think these Klingons are doing in these penal colonies? Are they like on...
nothing
say,
good.
I don't know. But are they doing the New Zealand thing like Tom Paris did? Or are they off to an Andorian mining colony like those other detainees were in contexts for kings? I'm just wondering what these Klingons really get to do in the midst of this war with the Federation.
Oh, you're saying under Starfleet, like as Starfleet prisoners. Okay, I thought you meant as Klingon prisoners of war.
Okay.
Oh, nothing good with those. I don't know. I just feel like they kind of keep them off to the side somewhere.
But I just wonder,
I don't
like,
think they're putting them into mining colonies.
But
do you?
Don't you think the Klingons would get very restless as prisoners of war?
Wouldn't that be the ultimate torture?
Well, is that the honorable thing to do, is become prisoner? I think a lot of them would want to take their own lives ahead of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it also makes me wonder, like, would a Klingon actually defect? I could buy a Romulan defecting or a Cardassian defecting.
Have we ever seen a Klingon want to switch sides?
You know what? It's tough if we try to paint everybody with a broad brush, because we've seen a lot of, you know, nuances within Klingons, you know? So... Klingon switching side. I'm trying to think. What about during the Klingon War in season 4 of DS9?
Okay.
We had, I don't know.
There's nothing jumps to mind.
Yeah. There's also that albino Klingon that we saw in Blood Oath.
Yeah.
That's, you know, who, maybe that's Volk. Who knows? But
right.
I don't know. I'm trying to think about like the different, like the more anomalous sorts of Klingons. And
I will say, though, when we look at the original series Klingons,
right.
While they may not line up well visually with these Klingons, they strike me as behaving very similarly. That very untrustworthy kind of sneaky kind of vibe where you can never quite know what they're going to do. I feel like once we get to the kind of the Berman era with TNG forward, Klingons are a little more predictable. You know, they follow an honor code. They're warriors, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Whereas the original series, they're much less trustworthy, and they are definitely always, you know, quite deceitful.
I feel like an idiot now.
Okay.
The House of Duras, they're all very much kind of... You know, their father was the defector to the Romulans, right? Like, he was kind of the secret sort of spy, and Moog got blamed for that.
Good call.
So, yeah, we I guess... I'll give it to them. There are some Klingons that
be so like... it's almost like the Duras, too, are kind of come from the original series type Klingons.
Are you guys disappointed we haven't gotten a House of Duras shout out at this point?
We will at some point.
What about
right?
a House of Moog shout out?
Do you think we'll get one? Before the series is over, yes, I do think we'll get one. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm okay with them doing a Klingon war story and not doing shout-outs to all of the famous Klingon houses right off the bat.
Fair enough. Why don't we talk a little bit about what's going on with Stamets, my favorite man right here. Did you guys notice he was in a bit of a Jesus Christ pose at the beginning of the episode as, you know, they had the...
the classic Tyler pose.
But he had the nails going into his appendages, you know, and he's not really enjoying his spore drive as
he's
much
like
as
he's like living in
was.
A Cronenberg movie.
it used to get him what it seemed like high, but now it seems like it's just draining him.
And I feel for his dilemma about going to the doctor. Although if it was me, I'd be going to the doctor like instantly.
So. And we saw a little bit of a reversion back to the Stamets we saw in, you know, early on.
Well, you and I were talking about that, Cam, about whether or not the Stamets that we've been seeing the last few weeks is the one we're going to be seeing going forward or
like
what?
The status quo Stamets.
Dale, what do you like more, the groovy Stamets or the persnickety Stamets?
I'd have to say the persnickety Stamets, because the groovy Stamets, you're like, this can't last. This isn't a character dynamic that will last among the crew. And
could you imagine him commanding his own ship one day?
I did like how he had, like, it was kind of just a little flavor for the episode, but he had that temporal shift where he called Tilly the captain. I think maybe they're going to try wrap up some, like, he's taking future memories back or whatever, since he's, like, cross time.
So do you think by the end of season one, Tilly will be in Lorca's chair? That was a joke.
No.
Dale's, for the listeners, Dale's looking thoughtfully in out the window going like,
Well, my thing was, I was like, does he... Oh, does Tilly... No, Tilly's not going to be. For some reason, I thought you asked me if Stamets would be in Lorca's chair, which I could see... And I had a crazy thought. I was like, what if Stamets evolves into Q at this point?
Okay.
I guess was, I say that's a crazy thought.
We're really swinging for it now.
it was. I think it was just more the like how his lackadaisical attitude last episode.
Right.
The whole temporal shift thing. He came across as very like... Oh, what'll happen? I know everything, but let's just see what you know. And
I don't know that I would ever see him become like a Q, but I could see him becoming something like a Gary Seven type character from the original series, or even like Barclay in the Nth Degree, where he just has too much, you know, kind of power. I could see us getting an episode like that from Stamets for sure.
I'm still digging the character.
Me too.
I don't know where we're going to find him by the end of the season. Because, Cam, you and I, we've been speculating, like, how long are a lot of these crew members meant to last on the series? You even bring up, going back to your question about Laurel, is she just going to be a one-off, like, sort of character just for the season, or will she continue on? I can say I hope she continues on.
She feels like a fan fave character to me. Like a future fan fave character.
I'm digging her.
Yeah,
she seems like she'll have a good redemption arc if she actually does defect.
Because she's got to be the most popular Klingon we've gotten off this series so far.
Yeah, the albino I was kind of into. And
Vogue, yeah.
Yeah, and then he kind of...
disappeared?
Yeah, I'm not sure where he is because he went on the Klingon ship that was at the Battle of the Binary Stars, right?
Well, yeah. It happened like Laurel was taking him to the, what were they, the maidens or something? What were they called? The mistresses? The Klingon?
Something like that.
The Klingon they're females.
Taking him back to her home house.
To lose everything.
To lose everything. Yeah.
And we have not seen him since.
He was chased away, according to her.
Yeah.
Huh. Oh, yeah.
So
maybe something happened where they just kind of off-screen killed him.
Don't you think that's kind of weird, Dale?
Yeah.
Don't you think it's weird that we haven't seen anything from Volk in about, what, 4 episodes now?
Yeah.
But we've seen Laurel twice since then?
Yeah. And no explanation?
Yeah, that's definitely weird. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just
saying.
Just saying. You know, I think some listeners might know what we're talking about. Others, I don't know. Keep your eyes open on that.
Yeah, for sure. So we kind of glossed over with the whole episode, but like, what did you guys think of this episode? Because, you know, like last week, Tyler, you and I were really big on magic to make the sanest man go mad. How did this episode, coming off of that great high point of the series, one of the great high points of the series so far, how did you feel about this episode, guys?
I would say it's still the show's still going in the right direction. More so than say, I was higher on this than an episode like Lethe, for example.
Right.
But not as much as Magic. So I think the writers are learning a lot about maybe what's working, what's not working. So so far I'm digging.
I feel like maybe it was a good spot to sneak in a weaker paced episode, because last week's episode was pretty good. And it was like you had that guest star. He's so good. And Mud is such a good character. And then you get to this and they're kind of like, we just want to slow it down. And what I was thinking when I watched this.
They want to slow it down for what would have been the mid-season finale.
Yeah, last episode would have been a better mid-season finale than this one.
In that where we leave off the characters versus maybe not so much from a storytelling perspective, though, right?
Yeah, no, not storytelling, just like emotional reaction to the episode.
Like really having a home run for the characters.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. Like this episode to me, like I really liked the stuff with Laurel, as I said, the Klingon stuff. I really liked the Stamets stuff. I thought the A story with Burnham and Saru on the planet was kind of a dead end.
Yeah.
It was obviously there to set up some sort of cliffhanger, but I did not find most of it very compelling.
Yeah, I agree. As much as I really want to like Saru and feel like I should be liking him, I didn't find it all that engaging. I was just kind of like, I kind of guessed where we're going to end up at by the end of this episode.
But did you even find this planet that interesting?
I appreciate the fact that, look, for most of Star Trek, a strange new world looks like a really cheap, like, Hollywood backlot, or else it looks like some canyon in California.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They're doing something different here. Sure. And I thought it was interesting.
It looked oddly familiar, Tyler.
I don't know, Cam. Was do you think they had a little bit of advice from one Mr. James Cameron or something like that?
I don't know. Yeah, no kidding.
Wait, is this the Avatar sequel we've all been waiting for, over the last 10 years? When did Avatar come out? Was it 2008?
2009. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's been almost a decade since Avatar.
This is the first time I felt like someone was paying homage to Avatar in a way that wasn't making fun of it.
Okay. I don't know. What did you think of the planet, Dale?
It was a little too blue. Like, I get, like, they're like, wow.
That's
like
racist against Navi. Yeah.
It's like planet Earth, but all the leaves are blue. I did like how, even as cheesy as it came across, like, the whole planet singing and the beings on the planet actually being the planet. I was interested in that whole aspect of it and how he was trying to communicate with them. But I felt like the giant crystallized antenna was a bit convenient. And
how far does this crystal antenna reach?
Yeah. And
it was a lot like the magical tree in Avatar.
And was there only one on the planet? Like, it would have been made sense if they showed other growths of crystals, and then this one kind of just was the tallest.
Yeah.
But it just looked like it was all trees and then one crystal out of nowhere.
Do you think this is like a prequel to the crystalline entity on Star Trek The Next Generation?
I can only hope.
Yeah. Okay.
I just thought, I don't know, there's something about when you have like little wisps coming going around as your aliens. I'm like, it's hard for me to really feel anything. Because I'm watching, you know, Saru communicate with, like, a dust cloud. And then, you know, it envelops him. And it's like, okay, sure. But, you know, I guess this is a very original series type thing. You would see this where it's like the invisible, you know. Like
metamorphosis, right?
Sure, yeah. Things mm-hmm. like that. I just never felt like the emotional impact that you would get in episodes like that.
Yeah, I agree with that. Although
it's
I do
like, okay, sure.
I do appreciate that we're not seeing yet another humanoid sort of being. I really liked in episode one where you had those kind of weird crab-looking aliens on that desert planet,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I'm glad that they're trying something else. I didn't need to see another humanoid alien that is really good at good vibrations on its home planet. You know,
Marky Mark.
I was thinking Beach Boys, but okay. You know. I think we know what song we're gonna end the episode with now, Cam. I don't know, guys, before we dive into, so we've got some viewer mail, a book review, we've also got the Ortonville Report to cap off this episode. Do we have any final thoughts about C.V. Pacem Parabellum?
Boom, you got it.
Nice, nice.
I like how Star Trek still doesn't have blankets when they sleep, because that was something that hung me up in The Next Generation, and then every once in a while, I'll see it, and I'll be like, no blankets in the future? Like,
yeah, there's this episode, I keep blanking on the name of it, but it was a Geordi episode where we find him sleeping in his uniform. Like,
like arms crossed.
Arms
like
crossed.
Like Nosferatu.
Yeah, no blanket. He's in, yeah. See, it is like so weird. Like, the man doesn't even have pajamas, and mm-hmm. he doesn't even have a blanket. It wasn't like he just took a nap and fell asleep. That's how he sleeps. And I was just like,
they had sleeping bags in Star Trek 5, right?
When they around were camping? The campfire?
Yeah.
Probably.
I would
I'd
think
assume.
So. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'll say this, though. If we're talking about Star Trek, you know, outfits, keeping people warm. Cam, you know, I got that onesie in Las Vegas.
Yes.
Right? This thing was very nice. Like, I won it during, was it One Trek Mind?
Yeah, I think
the
so.
The Jordan Hoffman thing?
Yeah.
And, I open it up and I look at the price tag. This thing's like $80 and I got it for free.
Mm-hmm.
It actually is very good for sleeping in. I'd say
oh,
that.
Nice.
You know,
yeah,
like
okay.
The weather in Vancouver has gotten miserably and unseasonably cold recently. And
yeah.
So I was walking around with it last night and I fell asleep in it and I did not need to put a blanket on. So maybe you don't need blankets by the 23rd century, Dale.
Nice.
Know?
Future fabrics, I guess.
Yeah. Cam, final thoughts on this one?
Yeah. Dale raised a point earlier about the opening spaceship battle mm-hmm. feeling like it's missing a few beats. Like mm-hmm. you just
okay.
don't kind of get to like kind of bask in it. That's kind of how I felt about a lot of this episode, where I'm flying through story beats and I'm not like getting any pause for emotional impact. And the only time I really felt like that was with the Laurel stuff, where it's like, it feels like this character is taking moments to think. I'm getting to kind of spend time with her. But when I was looking at like the Saru story, I felt like I was just flying through that. They're like, we got to cram that into 20 minutes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it just, to me, felt very glossy and underdeveloped in the way that I kind of went after Lethe for the same thing. And I felt that in a few of the Discovery episodes at this point. And it's a concern going forward. And I think part of the problem is cramming in. You basically have three stories in this episode.
Yeah.
And, you know, the episodes are shorter than ever. Or at least, well, maybe not as short as Enterprise. I don't know.
No, these ones, I think.
They're about 45, aren't they?
Yeah, about 45.
Yeah. I think Enterprise is like 42 usually.
Yeah.
But I feel like Enterprise somehow, despite being shorter, let me kind of, the stories kind of unfold at their own pace a little better than some of the Discovery stories have.
Okay. Yeah, I just wonder, though, even if we had a full episode devoted only to the planet Pavo.
That's what I want, Tyler.
But would this really work that well as a Saru episode? I wasn't all that invested in what was going on Pavo.
Yeah, I think they really...
Like,
you know,
Star Trek camping trips, we've seen a lot of them, and I've just never been all that sucked into them.
Yeah.
I think they've got to work. I hope maybe in season one they have another Saru story, because they need to work on their, like, kind of classic early Saru episode that really hammers down this character's conflict and why we are supposed to care about him.
Yeah.
You know, Data didn't get Measure of a Man until season two, but he did have some, like, data lore in season one. We had some really strong Data stories. I'm waiting for the Saru one that I can really say, man, that is a classic Saru story.
Well, yeah, okay, I'll be okay with great Saru moments. Sure. I think we can just get an accumulation of moments that even if it's not like an all-out Saru story, I'm still okay liking this character. You know, and we've gotten a lot of pretty like solid moments with him so far.
I'm a little bummed though that I can say, man, I've gotten two really good Harry Mudd stories. I've yet to get a really good Saru story.
I'd be much more invested in the Laurel stuff if I didn't think that the writers are really trying to pull some sort of big plot twist on the audience. And that's the feeling that I get nonstop from everything going on with Laurel.
Yeah.
And I probably am not going to like this plot twist nearly as much as the creators think I should. And that's my big fear here.
Do you think they'll ever make Cole interesting? He's kind of one-dimensional. He's the Klingon we're supposed to dislike. Do you think we're going to get more out of him?
I would rather see, is Kor his brother or his pops or what? I'm not exactly sure.
I don't know.
I would like to see some sort of interaction with this Kor, because he's part of House Kor.
Yeah.
And I think that could make him more interesting.
Yeah, just something to give him a little bit of a life beyond just barking orders at people and threatening people would be nice. Mm-hmm. Because that's the type of Klingons that aren't the most exciting to watch. And I feel like the character of Cole is someone who I want to like because he looks awesome. Mm-hmm. The actor
has got a cape.
He has a cape. The actor has a certain amount of charisma. Like, I feel like he's, it's Kenneth Mitchell plays this character. And I feel like he's bringing enough to this character that he shouldn't be just like a one-dimensional villain.
Yeah.
But the show is not yet giving this character that.
I just wonder if it comes down to what you're saying earlier. It's like there's so much story going on and maybe they're just a little spread thin. You know, they wish they could spend more time on this. And I think the one thing that Discovery really has going for it is characters. We may have criticized, you know, the development of Tyler so far.
Yeah.
But I think overall, like, and even this episode is a Saru-centric episode, but I think overall, I'm digging these characters' journeys.
This show has done a far better job than almost every series at establishing its entire cast early on. I mean, when we can poke fun at Ash Tyler, but that's the only one we can really poke fun at.
Yeah, it's almost like they're showing you the bookshelf, and each character is a book, and then you're like, oh, when are they going to take that one down and show us what's inside? And back to your Cole thing, I think he is one-dimensional, and they do need to either build him up or get rid of him either entirely or kind of until season two, where he rises again sort of deal.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, guys, why don't we do the Ortonville report first, Cam, and then we can spend the rest of the time just doing a little bit of a house cleaning here.
Sure.
But this episode of Orville, episode 8, I think, Into the Fold, we get our first episode really focused on Penny Johnson's character. We all know Penny Johnson as Cassidy Yates from Star Trek Deep Space Nine, but as Dr. Finn, she and Isaac the robot crash land on a planet with the Doctor's children, and we had no idea she ever had two children before this episode. And Isaac has to learn, because they're separated, the Doctor and Isaac has to learn how to take care of kids.
Right.
I don't know. It's
This sounds riveting, Tyler.
I know. It's the first episode with Bron and Braga getting a writer's credit.
Okay.
And we also have, I believe, Andre Baramas as well, another Star Trek writer. So they both have writer's credits, and this felt like a mediocre episode of Voyager.
Well, I had a theory a while back. You know, a lot of fans were saying, you know, they wanted a lot of the established Berman-era writers to come back for, like, another Star Trek series.
Sure.
And I commented to you, I mean, you know, for someone like Brandon Braga, he's had something like, I don't know, like 60 hit Star Trek episodes or 50 hit, like 50 really, really good to great Star Trek episodes.
Yeah.
Is that all he's got? Like, and that's fair. There's nothing wrong with, you know, cranking out a number of classics and being like, that's all I got, guys.
The problem is, would he just have to keep trying to one-up himself? Because what he's really known for is doing those real high-concept sorts of episodes like Genesis or Cause and Effect, you know, those things. I don't know how many more Cause and Effects he has up
his
sleeve.
Or Parallels, you know, another great one. Yeah.
So with this, I mean, this wasn't a horrible episode the way that last week's was, which to me I think was like the worst episode we've seen so far. It definitely wasn't a great one. I just found myself really bored, you know. So that's the Ortonville report.
And it got a season two, so.
Yeah, so I'll say this. While the Orville will be going to season two, I don't think the Ortonville report will be going to season two, but I will finish the first season, I'll keep reporting in. So I'm sure all the big fans of the Orville could look forward to me going like meh about the series. I've said it before. I think for a lot of Star Trek fans, this is kind of like comfort food.
Right.
But it's just not the kind of Star Trek kind of ripoff that I want to see or that I find engaging. I'll tell you what it is. I think I've kind of tracked it down. I'm more interested, and we've kind of touched on this during this episode, but I'm more interested in seeing what weird situations do to the characters that we like, you know. But the Orville seems more interested in just showing off weird situations.
Right.
So I'm not so invested in what's...
So it's more plot-based than character-based.
It is, and yeah. I think that's why last week's episode, Majority Rule, was just awful. It was just like a total snooze fest. But I don't know. I hope they figure something out that's maybe has appeal to me. I think it's working for a lot of fans. I got the season 2 pickup, so look, if you enjoy the Orville, have at it.
And you're getting more of it.
Yeah.
So, Dale, have you been watching it all?
No, I have not.
Okay.
Well, not because I'm vastly against it. It's just I don't have cable, and I am watching Discovery on Crave, and Orville's not on there, so I'm not watching it.
If Orville popped up on Crave in a few months, would you at least watch episode 1 just out of curiosity?
Oh, yeah. I'd give it a shot.
Yeah. Because there's so many Star Trek, you know, writers and producers, directors behind it. To me, it's the curiosity factor. That's why I keep tuning in every week. But
I mean, even if it is a watered down Star Trek, it's still got some Star Trek flavor in there.
Yeah, a little DNA.
Yeah.
So, okay.
So I was going to have a little segment here called Cam Fiction Corner.
Mm.
And I'm going to talk about the first Star Trek Discovery novel. That is Desperate Hours by David Mack. You know, there is a long, long, very long history of Star Trek tie-in novels, all of which Tyler has read. And
I think I let you borrow like the one that I liked,
Stitch
in Time.
Yeah.
And you were kind of like meh on it.
Yeah, it was all right. Yeah.
Okay.
Well. I mean, I'm fresh into the world of Star Trek novels. Back in the day, I read a lot of Star Wars novels. I just read the very first one, I think it's Die Spock Die or Spock Must Die, and it was all right. It was fairly entertaining. It was short, thankfully. but this one I was really curious to read because this is the launch of the sort of expanded, you know, literary Discovery universe with a very boring title called Desperate Hours again. it sounds like a Michael Keaton thriller from the mid-90s. But this story is essentially a match.
I'd say more Billy Baldwin.
But Billy Baldwin, okay. Yeah,
Billy Baldwin.
Post-backdraft?
Yeah,
okay.
Obviously.
This was a story.
Wait, what was the one with Cindy Crawford?
Fair Game.
Fair Game.
Yeah,
it sounds like Fair Game. Desperate Hours.
Well, there was Desperate Measures, which had Michael Keaton.
Gotcha. Anyway, sorry, Cam.
Yes. Well, and the next, I should say, Star Trek Discovery novel is called Drastic Measures.
Wow.
So we actually have Desperate Hours and Drastic Measures. Take a word from each. You get Desperate Measures, the Michael Keaton thriller.
Do you think that was on purpose?
I can only hope
so, yeah.
Weirdly boring titles, considering the long history of really interesting Star Trek novel titles. Like, they usually were really quirky and interesting.
Yeah, I don't Stitch
know.
In Time.
I don't get it. But, so this one is, was a story commissioned by Brian Fuller. And so it has a certain amount of, I don't want to say it's canon, but it's sort of semi-canon, I guess?
Well, the writer of this most recent episode, Kirsten Beyer, she's actually in charge of deciding what's canon and what's non-canon.
So the writers
within...
are definitely going off the, I would imagine, the Bible for the series. Yeah. Like, they aren't allowed to start inventing stuff that's not approved by the overall writer's room. So I was very interested for that reason to read it as well. And it's a story that kind of takes the crew of the Shenzo and teams them up with the crew of the Enterprise under the captaincy of Pike. And so, to me, that was interesting unto itself because, first off, who doesn't love Pike and Spock, et cetera?
Yeah.
And then the Shenzo, I always felt like those characters, I never got a good grasp on them before they were gone. So I was very interested
Dan B. Connor?
He's in this one. They call him like something like the ever-enterprising, you know, or they have a word for him that makes him sound really dynamic. And I'm like, sure.
Okay.
You know, this story itself, I think, is kind of, it's not great. It's a sort of Leviathan craft that's under the water. They call it the Juggernaut. and there's a mining colony planet.
A mining colony planet in Star Trek?
Yes.
I'm shocked.
Yes. And they have, like, kind of not done their survey forms properly. There's a whole segment on this. And so there's an ancient civilization underneath the water that rises with this juggernaut ship and puts the whole planet in peril. And this juggernaut could, you know, cause havoc to other planets nearby. It's kind of like, imagine like the Doomsday Machine or the probe from Star Trek 4.
And so, do Burnham and Spock get to interact at all?
Yes, that's it. It pairs off characters. Yes, as a plot based novel, I gotta say this was not riveting. There's a lot of description. I find, like, you know, we talked about space battles being not that interesting on Discovery. It's even less interesting to read them. You know, it's just like so much description on what people are pressing on their control panels and things like that. I'm like, I don't care. Get to the point. There's a lot of that sort of stuff. I didn't find the overall plot interesting where...
Although, Cam, can we recommend the other podcast, Mirror Wars? If
No comment.
Hey, any of you guys finding us on iTunes, also search for Star Trek Mirror Wars if you're looking for some interesting descriptions of starship battles.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway.
But anyway, so what happens is Burnham has to team up with Spock to go inside the juggernaut to try and figure out how to stop it before it takes down the whole planet and the galaxy and what have you. And so we get a lot of team up with them. And to me, this is where the novel worked. There's a lot of character dynamic stuff that I really enjoyed a lot that is given that is not featured in the series. Like, we get to go inside the heads of Burnham, Georgiou, as well as Saru. The stuff with Saru I thought was fantastic. They pair him off with number one from the cage, whose name is Una. And there's a little bit of kind of a flirtation there, and we see how this character is able to open up to someone who's a little more on his wavelength, and that's something we have not seen on Discovery yet.
Do we get to see the doctor from the Enterprise? The one who...
Dr. Boyce?
Yeah.
Oh, Dr. Boyce does show up.
Nice. Okay.
So there's a lot of little, like, Easter eggs for fans.
Sure.
And, you know, I liked reading a lot of the Georgiou stuff because I never felt like I got a good handle on that captain. This novel, I thought, did a good job in fleshing her out a lot and giving me at least an understanding as to how she commands a ship and also how, you know, this novel examines why she promoted Burnham to first officer and also lays breadcrumbs for why Burnham would stage a mutiny. Like, this is not foreign to her personality. And so I liked a lot of that stuff. Psychologically, this book is really good for delving into these characters. The one thing I didn't like, the one thing in terms of character that really rubbed me the wrong way is it has Pike in it. And his story is sort of going up against Georgiou. And he is often used as, like, the guy who's wrong. Georgiou is great because she is right. Whereas, you know, Pike is made to look kind of like a jerk. And I did not really care for that. That's kind of a lazy device, I think.
So you've described the book, but can I ask you this? Is it well written, though? Because that's my big problem with a lot of these Star Trek novels is that... They're not very well written, though. Some of them are, but
it's written fine.
Okay.
Like, I don't think it's offensive. I think the Mac spends a little too much time on very florid descriptions of control panels and alien technology and what it all looks like in words. At a certain point, you're like, I can't even imagine what this thing looks like anymore.
Is that the old trick back in university where you had a 1,000-word paper due, so you just fill it up with fluff? You know,
a little bit. You know, you know, this Discovery has been very good on not filling out its hour with technobabble or treknobabble. This book is not so good at that.
Okay,
but I will say, for those who are on the fence, if you want to learn more about the character sort of psychology of Saru, Georgiou, Burnham, and it really delves a lot into the Burnham-Spock relationship in a way that I did not expect. For that sort of stuff, it's definitely worth reading. And I will read Drastic Measures, and I'll weigh in on how that compares when it comes out in February.
Would you say that this book, it's like what you're saying about how it describes all the characters, would it be good as sort of a primer for Discovery?
Well,
or
that's
would it
the
give
interesting
stuff
thing,
away?
Because it came out in, I think, maybe week 2 or 3 of Discovery. I think they should have had this novel on the book stands maybe like 6 weeks before the show premiered.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I actually think fans would have, especially the fans who were really hard on the series out of the gate, would have gotten a lot out of this novel going in. Like, I remember back in the day, they would often release novelizations of movies well in advance of the movie. And I remember going to some of these movies, like Ninja Turtles, but with like a real understanding of what the characters, what was going on in their head that made the movie a little more alive to 11-year-old me or 12-year-old me. I actually think that the first two episodes of Discovery would have meant a lot more to people had they read this novel.
Okay, yeah.
So I don't know. Interesting choice to not kind of hype up the Shenzhou crew in advance of that two-parter, because it's not like we've gone back to them.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Interesting choice.
I'm sure there's going to be more Giorgio flashbacks. And
sure.
We still have the Shenzhou like sets. We know that from a few episodes ago. So I'd be disappointed if we don't get like at least one more flashback to the Shenzhou. Like I had fun in those two episodes with that crew. Like, well, I don't know if fun's the right word, but like...
the times we had.
But it's Cam, I've mentioned it on the podcast before. I like the idea of... following a Star Trek or a series where you're going around and helping planets open wells or fixing relay stations. Yeah. You know, like I could kind of dig the idea of following that crew over this one, even though I like the characters here.
Like a feel-good Trek.
I'm a very simple man, Dale. I just need to feel good.
I think what they could do is they keep showing Detmer just like, always there as a reminder.
She has a lot more to do in the book.
Yeah, acknowledged.
She's got like the stuff in her head.
Yeah.
And you're like, wow, she must have got really injured. She must be pissed. Well, I guess I didn't address it this episode.
No, maybe I keep waiting for a big Detmer episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that is something that, you know, an advantage to the book is that, like, I understood the Saru character more from that book than anything I've seen on the series really so far, which is a little damning. Same with Kayla Detmer. So, all you Detmer fans out there, give it a shot. Now, I guess we have some incoming transmissions from this week.
Yeah, you want to start with the YouTube stuff, Cam?
Okay, so this was one comment we had from Chris Pearson. We talked when we talked about last week's episode about sort of the recreation areas of the various Star Trek ships. He just wanted to point out there was decent sports and social areas on the refit Enterprise from Wrath of Khan, etc. Hardly seen outside the first movie, though, first couple movies. And yeah, we did see the games room in...
that look fun? Especially, it was Commander Decker showing that to Ilya, right?
Yeah.
That looked like a blast.
It looked like there's a 1983 unofficial Bond movie called Never Say Never Again, and there's a scene where Bond goes up against the villain playing this quote-unquote futuristic video game. That's the type of stuff it looked like. Yeah. Really hokey.
Quote-unquote.
That was just to chime in on a point we made. But we got a comment from Kimberly. Talking about the Discovery party, she says, I'm a lame enough person that all the 10 forward events would totally be my scene, and I'm a big fan of the old standards they'd have Vic playing on DS9. Why you gotta diss me like that, fellas? The Discovery party seems more appropriate for a young crowd. I don't see anything wrong with it, even if I'd be a total Burnham if I'd been invited.
I'm young at heart, so there you go.
I'm rapidly aging by the day, but...
I should mention this. Listeners, we're literally recording this episode on Cam's birthday.
Yeah.
You realize that your birthday fell on a Sunday.
Yeah.
And you had to tell your family that, sorry, I can't go over for dinner.
Yeah,
tonight.
I did it last night. Yeah. Rescheduled it for Star Trek Discovery.
Well, I like those priorities.
Yeah.
It's all I have.
So we got some listener mail sent to our Gmail account, and this is from Audrey Wynn. Says, long-time listener, first time writing in. I love listening to the two of you because even though you have your favorite Trek, you both generally approach every topic or episode of any Trek with an open mind. My favorite Trek is TOS, like Cam, for character chemistry and sentimental reasons more than anything, and I really hope Discovery can capture more of the vibes that made me love TOS so much. Disco's had a rough start, in my opinion, but hopefully the writers will hit their strides and take off like DS9 did. My second favorite Trek. Keep up the good work. That's from Audrey Wynn. Very interesting insights from her. In that, I think it does take a little while to get a Star Trek series going. Mm-hmm. I think the one that was most...
Usually three seasons.
You know, I know. But the one that was probably obviously most fully formed out of the gate would have been the original series.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of an apt comparison of her bringing this up, TOS versus Discovery as well. She said DS9's her second favorite. That's my first. So I think with regards to taste, you and I, we're not too far away from Audrey.
No, and I know that DS9 is a real, like... A very like big highlight they wanted to kind of reference a lot when they were taking on Discovery. Like they in interviews were saying, like, we're really looking at Star Trek Deep Space Nine because of the arc-based storytelling, and hopefully they ascend to the heights that Deep Space Nine hit eventually.
I have a question on compared to other Star Treks and the writing and hitting their stride. Do you think Discovery is going to have anything like Riker has a beard in season 2?
Oh, like kind of that moment that kind of pivots the whole series. Kind of like Kes leaves, 709 shows up, Riker beard, that sort of thing.
Yeah, just like something where they're like...
Although, is the Riker beard the moment where it pivots, or do we, is it when we get to season three?
I think it's like the season three uniform.
More like
the,
when...
the uniform change there.
That or Crusher comes back, or something like that.
Yeah, just something where they're like, okay, we've tooled it a bit, and you can notice it's different.
Kind of like when Worf showed up on DS9. Like that that was a bit of a pivot there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Did Enterprise have... was that, do you think, the Zindi war arc? Do you think that was
once
a pivot?
Once the Zindi attack Earth, that's kind of when the series takes off. Yeah.
Okay, so I don't know. Do you think we're going to get Saru with a badass goatee?
I mean, the thing about Discovery is the writers have not at all been shy about saying they're going to kill characters on the show. So I feel like you could have multiple points. You know, there's going to be countless characters getting off throughout the series.
Post Landry episodes.
Are we going to have a death pool of who gets it next? Or
yeah,
who would be your guess?
Honestly, I think Saru's time is limited.
Really
interesting. Okay,
and it sucks because this was a good Saru episode, and we've been talking about Saru all this and how we want to see him evolve. But I think the him attacking his crew and the way he looked in the hospital bed and kind of looked away is like a little bit of foreshadowing.
There was no real strength to that moment.
Yeah.
In that hospital bed. It was never like, boy, that's Saru. He's still going to be awesome on the bridge. It was kind of like, well, there's a broken man.
Yeah. And it was weird how Lorca didn't address what happened because they come back. They'd all just been like fist fighting each other. And then they're like, all right, welcome back.
Yeah. Death pool for me, I would say probably Lorca. I think
you think Lorca?
Yeah. Well, you and I talk about this, Cam. Like, we don't think he's going to be in the captain's seat by season two. This is not based on any spoilers, just our own speculation about whether this guy can be redeemable. I don't want to see him killed off. I would find it far more interesting if he has to leave in disgrace or...
Like stripped of his power.
Yeah, you know, but I can see them, you know, wiping the slate clean and saying, see you later, Lorca.
You know, a character...
If they're not shy about killing characters off, who do you think it would be if it's going to be a main cast member?
Part of me thinks it's going to be Ash Tyler, if only because this character, if you look at what he's being used for, it's like, oh, here's Berman's romantic interest.
Yeah.
You know, they're kissing out in a tent or whatever. It feels like he's there to draw something out of Burnham, only for that to get ripped away from her.
Yeah.
Like, this is not going to be a happily ever after in any way, shape, or form.
I already have my own speculation about why they're pairing these characters up.
But, I could see him being next.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
That's what I feel. Like, this character is being presented on screen as too good to be true.
It's how people feel about me.
Maybe you're next.
Well, my name is Tyler. So.
There you go. Yeah.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you want to join the conversation, jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. We have videos up there. There's weekly discussion going on about the latest episode, as well as blogs. Tyler, what did you write about this week?
Yeah, I took a look at the episode Remember Me from Star Trek The Next Generation, and we did a comparison of magic to make the sanest man go mad. And I know a lot of people are thinking like, oh no, Tyler, this is cause and effect, you know, this is the time loop episode. But I was just like, yeah, but you know what, I like the idea of people being in like these very weird universes. They know that something's askew, so why don't we discover what's going on thematically? That I think cause and effect was not really a character-based episode. It's more of a cool, high-concept, typical Brandon Braga episode, whereas I think Remember Me is very much more character-based, and I definitely think that Magic was a far more character-based episode than cause and effect. So I had fun comparing those two. Cam, what about you?
Yeah, I kind of took a similar tact. I'm obviously comparing to movies, not other Star Trek episodes. So I looked at the movie Groundhog Day, which is a pretty obvious comparison for Magic to make the sanest man go mad. But like you said, a lot of fans, I think, were like, well, it's cause and effect.
Right.
And I saw several people say, well, this is like a TNG homage. And sure, it is to a certain degree. As you said, like a lot of the character-based stuff is in no way cause and effect.
No.
That is a plot-based episode about kind of solving the gimmick of the episode. Whereas I looked at the movie Groundhog Day and how the characters changed throughout it, as well as how Magic actually takes it a step further into the realm of like fairy tale. Which was an interesting sort of, it's something we haven't quite seen in that sort of approach to that story. And so, yeah, check that out over at the Facebook page. Next week, we'll be back with the final episode of the first half. Well, more than the first half, I guess, before the break of Discovery. This episode is called Into the Forest I Go.
Is that another allusion to Lewis Carroll?
Yeah. Yeah, Lewis Carroll, fairy tales.
Are they going back to the blue trees of Pavo?
Oh, I think that's for sure. Yeah. That's for sure. Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in vibrations, comma, good vibrations. Smith?
Yeah, you can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O-R-T as in trout, O-N.
And Dale?
You can find me at SuperDaleBot.
Tell us a little bit. You do have a podcast, though.
I do have a podcast with my friend Derek Boland. It's called Outrage Factory. And we try to take a look at what's making people mad on the internet, where they should or shouldn't be. And then we discuss that situation and people's outcry for, I guess, what they want justice for something. Usually it's something trivial and we feel they shouldn't be entitled to that much rage.
Yeah.
So what was like one of your most recent episodes about?
Well, Trump comes up a lot, obviously, but we always preface it, well, we don't want to talk about Trump, but we're going to talk about Trump.
Right.
Trudeau comes up. I don't know why I'm drawing a blank, but because we just recorded on Friday. And
As soon as we finish recording, Cam, it's just wiped from my memory. Like,
it's
I have
all,
to be
yeah, it's on to the next one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we did record at midnight, so I don't know why I'm drawing a blank.
It's all good. Yeah. So
maybe you'll just have to check it out to see what we're about.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed. Donnie D's on the back up, truck free, so put the crack up. No need for speed, I'm anti-D-R-U-T-G-I-E. My body is healthy, my rhymes make me wealthy. And the funky bunch helps me to bring you a show with no intoxication. So come on, feel my vibration. Yeah, can you feel it, baby?
Transfer complete.